Has research found that any of these assessments help in any of these ways that they achieve those goals? Because we know that they spend a lot of time and energy doing them. The science basically says that they're not useful at all.
Animal rescue is facing an unprecedented challenge. Shelters across the world are heaving with abandoned pets, particularly dogs, and many shelters have taken to operating waiting lists as the demand for kennel space massively outstrips the supply at their centres. This problem has been building since the relaxation of COVID restrictions across the globe, culminating in a tsunami of unwanted dogs due to a combination of factors, many stemming from the high demand for what have become known as pandemic puppies. According to a study by the Royal Veterinary College, pandemic puppy owners were more likely to be first-time dog owners, to have children in their household, and pay a deposit before seeing their puppy, compared to 2019 puppy purchasers. In the rush to find an excuse for longer walks outside, a companion for the kids to play with, or simply a distraction from the ever-present gloom of lockdown restrictions, many people with inadequate education and awareness about responsible pet caregiving give in to the impulse to acquire a pet. Headlines in 2020 were full of optimism for our furry companions. Coronavirus, animal shelters clear out twice in 1 week as pets get adopted in droves, chimed The Independent in March 2020. The call has been answered. Animal shelters across the US are emptying amid coronavirus pandemic, sang NBC News in April that same year. Although at the time, I too was delighted that so many needy animals had found homes, I did wonder what this meant when we are all eventually forced to go back to full-time work and school outside of our homes. But there was a darker story underlying every good news article. If people couldn't get a dog from a shelter, where else would they turn? Due to the demand for pups, breeders began to charge thousands for a puppy who, a year ago, would have cost a few hundred. Capitalizing on the opportunity to make a quick buck, backyard breeders and puppy farms were making money hand over fist. A responsible breeder will, or at least should, screen for genetic problems to ensure they're breeding healthy puppies, keep them with mum until they're strong enough to leave her, and provide some early socialization. Inexperienced breeders are unlikely to know enough about genetics or dog behavior and physiology to do this or do it well, while puppy farms ignore these necessities altogether, putting profit above all else. So now we have a huge number of animals, many of whom have questionable breeding and little normal socialization as pups, plonked into a home environment where their inexperienced caregivers don't know how to fully meet their breed's specific needs. They're getting a lot of human attention inside of their family, but are meeting almost no one, dog or human, outside of their household during that critical puppy period where they should be learning how to deal with the outside world. In a twist that surprised exactly no one who's ever met a human, once the long-term commitment and responsibilities associated with pet care became apparent, particularly with meeting the needs of a poorly socialized and potentially sick adolescent dog, people began to question their choices to bring a dog into their home. Cue an economic downturn and soaring inflation, and before they've had so much as time to catch their breath, the shelters are fuller than ever. Despite this excess of unwanted animals, many people who approach a shelter to adopt have found the process prohibitively difficult. Those who have answered the adopt, don't shop call of animal welfare organisations are incredibly disappointed when they learn that the shelter will not allow them to adopt one of their animals. So what happens then? Do they forget about getting a dog and give up? Or do they go elsewhere? To a breeder, perhaps? Do these stringent policies actually help the animals? What are these policies based on? If rescues are turning away a lot of people, there must be a good reason, right? While trying to make this make sense to me, I approached someone who has been working in this field and asking these questions for years.
I'm Dr. Karen Griffin. I'm a research scientist. I'm a researcher at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, and I'm also the founder and executive director of the Dog Rehoming Project, which is a nonprofit organization. My background before I kind of worked in this field was actually in the social sciences, in psychology and sociology, and I somehow or another kind of segued, pivoted into working with dogs. At first I was doing it practically. I was working in like a sheltering or rehoming environment, and then I really missed research. So I decided that I was going to do a PhD. That was the plan. So I, you know, looked around, see what opportunities were available. I ended up doing my PhD and then doing it at the University of Lincoln in the UK. And I knew broadly what was happening in the US and in the UK. I knew that there were all these dogs that, and cats, but all these dogs that were in shelters, and there was just things going on. There are high euthanasia rates for purely for space reasons in the US, as is true elsewhere also. And I knew that we needed to investigate scientifically what was going on. Over the course of the various studies that comprised my PhD, I realized that a lot of organizations, both in the UK and in the US, seem to be doing things in a certain way in terms of their policies and procedures and practices, because it's what they'd always done. And so there wasn't any like scientific rationale, much less any just logic. It's kind of like, oh, that's what seems like a good idea. Let's keep doing it. Of course, all with the goal in mind of improving the welfare of dogs, but there wasn't any scientific evidence to support it. It's just kind of what we think. And I just saw this like big gap between science and practice.
So having identified some areas of research, she dove right in. Or, well, sort of.
There was a demand for the research. There was clearly a need. There were researchers that wanted to do the work. There was just no money.
Funding, or lack thereof. That is certainly at least one area that rescue centers and scientists can agree on.
And that's really what underpins the Dog Rehoming Project. Unfortunately, in this field, there is very, 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 very little funding for research, even though it's very much needed. The small amount of funding that really does exist often focuses on how animals can benefit humans. How can dogs make humans' lives better? There's a tiny amount of money that actually focuses on dogs' welfare, and never mind dogs that are in like a shelter, rehoming environment.
But that wasn't the only struggle.
To do research, you need a lot of participation. You need people, you need dogs, you need organizations. And to get people who kind of owned their dogs to be involved in studies, it was no problem. They're like, yeah, I'll do whatever you need, sure. To get organizations, so shelters or rescue centers, to get involved, that was much harder. They're very resource poor. Even if they want to be involved, they just don't have the time, the resources, anything. So I thought, okay. But I also know that there's some interest there. So there has to be an easier way to kind of match science and studies and the people and organizations who want to be involved, because basically you waste a lot of time just trying to recruit participants.
Finding money and participants to try and bridge this gap sounds like a tall order. But if anyone was up for it, it was Karen Griffin.
I'm kind of a go big or go home kind of person. Like, let's not just do one small thing, let's do three big things. There's no money. There's an issue with rounding up participants, and also we need to bridge this gap between science and practice. So with those three very big lofty goals in mind, I decided to start a nonprofit that was going to address all three.
The Dog Rehoming Project has been in existence since 2021 and has been working to bridge that gap between science and the practical side of animal rescue through communicating research to those who can actually use it.
I love research and I love science, but it's no good to anybody really if it's just sitting in a journal. I would say sitting in a journal on a shelf, but that doesn't really exist anymore. So sitting in a journal online, all the only people who are going to read it are other researchers, which isn't particularly useful. What we've really been focusing on since we started a couple of years ago was disseminating the scientific research to the people and organizations who need it, but giving it to them in a way that they can understand, so it's comprehensible.
Having been out of the world of academia for a few years, and while trying to run a very busy shelter, I find reading journal articles to be too time-consuming and, well, not very exciting. And this is coming from a science nerd. The Dog Rehoming Project website had a lot of resources that made it much easier to find the answers I was looking for, and helped me make evidence-based decisions on running the sanctuary. But with my academic training a bit rusty, it was still a struggle to make head or tail of the research.
Like I said, comprehensibility, how people understand the research, because research can be very technical and sciencey. I'm a researcher and often I read papers and I have no idea what they're talking about. So never mind someone who doesn't work in this field at all. So we kind of think, okay, how can we give this to them? So we do things like infographics. We do that obviously show text and, you know, have some visual supports as well, interviews with researchers, and then we kind of do like simple summaries. So different ways of getting the information across and a way that's accessible. For example, in terms of accessibility, you know, you might not easily be able to, someone who works in this kind of fast-paced world might not easily be able to sit down and watch something for an hour, or might not be able to sit and read for an hour, whatever. So different ways of giving the information, also different ways of learning and absorbing the information.
She's not wrong about this. An average day working at an animal shelter involves cleaning kennels, feeding and medicating animals, vet visits, health checks, walking, enrichment, socialization, answering emails, dealing with the public, trying to take pictures and videos of animals to help promote them to potential adopters, making phone calls and following up with potential adopters, taking phone calls from people who want to relinquish their animals, scheduling animals to come in, meet and greets, adoption paperwork, relinquishment paperwork, insurance paperwork. The work is endless, and many shelters rely on a skeleton staff and volunteers, or are completely volunteer-led, meaning they barely get enough time for a lunch break, never mind sitting down and reading up on the latest scientific advancements. So how does Dr. Griffin and her colleagues help these frazzled animal rescue workers?
So basically what we do is we say, okay, here's the science around a topic. So for example, here's the research about pre-adoption behavior assessments. We know that organizations do them widely, varying forms of them, either well-established assessments or just kind of in-house cobbled together. We know that they do them. We understand why they do them. They want to try to ensure, that's their goal, good welfare of the dogs, they're not relinquished, and also obviously to mitigate safety risk to humans. So to hopefully not have a dog that, you know, mauls a child when he goes home. So we know they want to do this. So we know that they're doing this, we know what their goals are, but actually, what's the usefulness? Has research found that any of these assessments help in any of these ways that they achieve those goals? Because we know that they spend a lot of time and energy doing them. And so actually, if you look at the science, which is a lot of research has been dedicated to evaluating the usefulness of these assessments, and specifically what we're really wondering about is when we assess a dog prior to adoption, is what we're seeing now predictive of what the dog will do in a home? So are these behaviors that they're showing right now the same thing that they're going to show when they get into a home?
The rescue shelter is a completely unnatural environment for a dog who has been used to living in a home. Imagine that you were taking out of your warm, cozy bed, the kitchen and sofa that you're used to, and were tossed into a cell with no access to anyone you know, and no one has told you why you're here or how long you're going to be here for, and you only get out for fresh air a couple of hours a day. Would you go about your daily business in the same way? React to people in the same way? React to unknown noises and interact with those around you in the same relaxed way you do at home? Of course not. But yet, this seems to be what we expect of dogs. Of course, some dogs cope better than others in a shelter environment, and for some really unlucky animals, the shelter is much better than where they've come from. But labeling an animal who is confused and highly stressed, and then using this label to restrict options for that dog, seems not very wise or kind to the animal. So why do we do these batteries of tests and assessments? There must be some valid and logical reason.
the science basically says that they're not useful at all. They're not very predictive. Yeah, there are certain bits and pieces possibly of one test that might be useful, but overall, they're not really helpful. So we took this research, a portion of it, and we said, okay, here's the science. Here's what they found. And we give rehoming organizations potential adopters, because also in this case, you know, they want information about their dog before they bring the dog home. But the problem is, we need them to know the information that they're being given isn't necessarily reliable and accurate. So to kind of take things with a grain of salt, to kind of say, okay, this is the science, this is what they found. And now that they've found this, this is how you can amend your policies and procedures and practices based on that evidence. With the goal, of course, of yes, ultimately improving dog welfare, but also in the meantime, improving organizations' efficiency in terms of staff time, etc.
With staff time and resources being at a premium, you would think that rescues would be chomping at the bit to save time. But this hasn't always been the case. Many rescues are afraid of public perception of what would happen if a dog acts out in a home that they hadn't gone through with assessments. Others have been doing these assessments for decades and are worried about the implications of facing up to years of well-meaning but ultimately ill-advised practice. Having faced resistance to questioning the status quo myself, I wondered if this was something that Dr. Griffin had experienced.
Yes, I've had organizations, even when I contacted them years ago when I was doing my PhD to collect data, just to ask them about some of their different practices. I had people come back to me that actually had some quite harsh words for me. What are you doing? You don't know. You don't work in this field. You can't tell us what to do. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just asking you some questions. And I do get it. Like, everyone's end goal is improving dogs' welfare. The problem is sometimes the way to improve their welfare isn't necessarily in line with what should be done. So yes, there's absolutely been some resistance for sure. And you know, it can be difficult to possibly explain the ins and outs of why behavior assessments aren't useful. They're provocative. Dogs, when they go into a shelter, their stress hormones go through the roof. Like, there are all these kind of technical components. So if you just, take a step back.
Taking a step back, taking a breath, and making clear-headed decisions in a fast-paced, high-stress workplace such as rescue can be difficult, there's no doubt. But surely there must be others that realize that stopping and questioning our own methods and beliefs regularly can only be a good thing.
You know, it depends. There are, you know, some more progressive organizations. Dogs Trust in the UK is very progressive. They have a whole research arm. And, you know, in the US and in the UK, yeah, you have these huge organizations that rehome a lot of dogs, but you also have these really tiny rescue organizations that might only rehome a few dogs a month. And sometimes they are really open to like, oh, that's really interesting. And they don't have to go through a whole like rewriting of like bylaws and this whole like board process. And they can just say, okay, if we just tweak a few things, that might be interesting. There definitely can be some resistance because someone coming in and saying, hey, you need to do all these things differently can be really, really hard. Like, I can see why you get defensive. So we kind of try to like take a step back and say, I understand what you're doing. I understand why you want to assess dogs' behavior before they're adopted. But also, if we just look here and we just take a second and we kind of regroup, we can actually improve the likelihood that they're going to stay in home in different ways. We can mitigate safety risk. You're wasting your resources on something that's not helpful. I mean, there will always be organizations, they're unwilling to change. They don't want to hear from you. It's just the way it's going to be. But there are a growing number of organizations and people and adopters and trainers who are very receptive. So it's just a matter of who and where. Yeah.
So if we ditch assessments that are not useful, how can we learn about the dog's personalities and behaviors in a way that we can use to help match them to good homes?
There are some other ways, actually, we might be able to get a lot more useful information. So if a dog is in a foster home, just kind of talking with the foster family in kind of a casual way, you might actually get a lot more insight.
Another bone of contention is home visits. This is when a member of staff or volunteer from the shelter will come to the potential adopter's house to assess the suitability of that environment for that specific dog. During COVID, these visits were stopped by many rescue centers or went online via video calls. Although this was a good time saver for the rescue, it created a barrier for those who, for one reason or another, do not have access to such technology. This meant that potentially brilliant homes were being forced out of the equation for a shelter dog. While the amount of homeless dogs continues to climb, and the pool of adopters gets smaller with each additional economic strain on the public, this policy seems to be doing more harm than good overall. Similarly, some people, myself included, are incredibly uncomfortable with strangers in their home, particularly one with a clipboard who is there with the express duty of judging your environment. Many perfectly normal people with nothing to hide feel home visits are quite invasive, and it puts them off the whole idea of adopting. So once again, shelters are risking pushing out would-be adopters into the arms of breeders, increasing the demand for bot dogs and fueling the breeding industry. So insisting on a home visit must be based on some strong rationale, right?
To date, there's no research that's investigated the usefulness of home visits, but we know that they take a lot of time. You have to get the staff, the volunteers, whatever, to go and check out the home. And then actually from some of my own published research, a lot of the home checkers or people who do the home visits aren't trained. There's loads of subjectivity. And yeah, there's no necessary correlation between the welfare of the dog, the safety of the people, the likelihood that they're going to stay in the home or be returned, and these home visits. So I think acknowledging that why people want these things, that you're not kind of dropping the ball and giving a dog to anyone, and saying, we get it. We know why you want this, but we're going to adjust our policies this way because actually the research supports that if we make these shifts, if we stop doing home visits for the time being and we instead do X, Y, and Z, then actually research shows that the likelihood of a successful placement in every capacity is much greater.
Seeing the disconnect between science and practice can be incredibly frustrating for those of us who want the best outcomes for dogs in rescue.
We know that there are people that want dogs. We know that there are plenty of dogs that need homes. So why aren't these dogs going to homes more readily? Why are people being so turned away? And what it seems like, and I think there's some research that's found this, when they want a dog, they want a dog. So if they can't get one from a rescue, they're on a mission. And so then they're probably going to turn to a breeder. And hopefully that breeder is reputable and the dogs are in good health, but they might not be. Or they might be sourcing dogs from out of the country that come from very suspicious sources. So we have to keep these things in mind.
Like me, during her time working in rescues, Dr. Griffin realized that this was a huge problem and one that rescues were essentially creating for themselves.
People wanted to adopt a dog. They want to go to a rescue. They want to go to a shelter. They want to not go to a breeder or not get a dog from some dodgy source. But when they go get a dog, the barriers that exist to getting a dog are often insane. And this isn't the case across the board. Of course, there are exceptions. But here they're trying to do what they would prefer to do. You know, they know that there are a lot of dogs that don't have homes, that need homes. And they would likely make a really decent home. But because they don't have the specific, you know, necessary criteria, there are a lot of organizations that say, if you don't have meet X, Y, and Z criteria, you can't have a dog. That's it. So for example, you'll see things like, you must have a 6-foot fence in your garden. If you do not have a 6-foot fence, you cannot have a dog. Well, someone who maybe doesn't have a 6-foot fence, A, might have like a chihuahua, so what a moot point, but also maybe they don't let their dogs off lead in the backyard, or maybe they're always outside with their dogs. so the high fence isn't necessary.
But this isn't the case across the board. Some organizations take a very common sense, case-by-case approach to adopting out, often to the point that would horrify the traditionalists in the field.
So, you know, some smaller organizations, I remember there was one, I have no idea what it was called. It was a little tiny rescue organization in the UK. And when I had contacted them and I was doing the study about rehoming policies and procedures and I was gathering data, and I, you know, asked my questions, like, what kind of information do you want? Is there any like specific criteria that an adopter must have? And I remember the person came back to me and said, no, like, we're very flexible. We recently adopted a dog to a family who lives on a houseboat, because that was a really suitable home for the dog. Like, they were gonna meet the dog's needs, and they lived in a houseboat, so they don't have a back garden.
It can be difficult to put emotions aside and choose policies carefully that are supported by science. For every 100 success stories with one policy, there will be one failure, one outcome that was less than desirable, be it for the dog or for the humans involved. Unfortunately, as human beings, we tend to focus on negative events. Psychologists even have a name for this, the negativity bias. According to a paper written by Vash, Grossman, and Woodward, negativity bias refers to our proclivity to attend to, learn from, and use negative information far more than positive information. This is the reason why, after a meeting with your boss, you will ruminate on that one less than positive aspect of your work that she talked to you about, no matter how many other compliments and accolades you received in the same meeting. In the same way, that one bad experience where it didn't all go to plan 4 years ago will live on in our minds. And this is more pronounced for the highly sensitive and caring people that are drawn to rescue work. What happens then is this one negative outcome will outweigh all of the positives, leading us to make more conservative decisions that can lead to animals being in shelters a lot longer than they need to be. And as length of stay increases, so do stress hormones, which in turn decrease both the immune system of the dog and their ability to cope, meaning sicker dogs with more behavioural issues in the shelters. And who wants to adopt a sick dog with behavioural issues? These animals are then stuck in a negative spiral of worsening health, reduced well-being, and reduced chances at a life outside the shelter. And we must give them every chance possible at getting out of the shelter.
A dog that's in a home will, in general, do better than a dog that's in a loud shelter environment.
So knowing this, organizations like the Dog Rehoming Project are invaluable in helping to provide the necessary data to help make informed decisions for overstretched rescue center decision makers who may not have the capacity to do all of the research themselves. It is vital that, as they write in their homepage, that rescue centers lead with science. So I asked Dr. Griffin, how can we support the Dog Rehoming Project's amazing work?
So like I said, we are a nonprofit organization. So we're a registered charity in the US, although all of our research is international in scope. Not only the US has this problem, everywhere does. So that being said, you can make donations through our website. So that's there. The other thing that I will say that also supports us and is very informative is we do monthly webinars on various topics. So actually, December, we did an expert panel, people who work in behavior, and we were kind of addressing like holiday behavior issues, things that might crop up with people coming and going from the home and just kind of chaos. And so all of the tickets are by donation. So we want it to be accessible to everyone. So if all you can afford is a few dollars, a few pounds, it's fine. We want you to benefit from the information. So yeah, so those are kind of the two ways. Yeah, go to our website. There's donate buttons everywhere. Or like I said, there are other things that we do that are by donation, like those webinars. So I guess I would say, I totally understand that, you know, you only have a few dollars or pounds to give. And so you want to, you know, maybe give it to an organization so they can buy food or so they can, you know, do X, Y, and Z. I'm not saying that that's not worth it. It totally is. Dogs need to eat. Having said that, the funds that are donated to us, it's a bigger picture thing, how the money is used, but it's used in ways to ultimately help organizations, help people to improve the dog's welfare. It's just a bit of a longer game. If we kind of take a step back and we say, okay, we know you're doing it this way, but actually, if you kind of shift things a little bit in this direction and change things up a little bit, you can make some really positive changes. So I know that that can be kind of abstract for people to get their head around.
Given the rehoming crisis we find ourselves in, I think research like this and shifting our thinking to big picture and long-term goals is desperately needed. Hopefully this episode will spark some conversations and play a small part in the revolution. As they say, desperate times call for desperate measures. So putting our feelings aside to favor a perhaps somewhat colder, more logical approach may be necessary. And luckily, we have great organizations like the Dog Rehoming Project to help us along. If you would like to support this great organization in their work, you can find them at www.thedogrehomingproject.org. You can also follow them on social media. Just search The Dog Rehoming Project. Thanks for listening. This episode was researched, written, and produced by me, Catherine Cray, with the help of my wonderful guest, Dr. Karen Griffin. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Animalistic. If you have, please share it with those who you know are interested in this topic. And if you're interested in hearing from more experts in the field of scientific, philosophical, and legal animal issues, check out some earlier episodes and subscribe for future updates. Until next time, stay safe, be kind.